Welcome back to AllThingsTrek.com, folks. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
So I had some pretty yummy turkey over at my grandma's place this year.
Well, we actually didn't have a turkey over on Vashon Island at our Thanksgiving. We went with chicken and duck, just because we realized that none of us really like turkey that much. And if you get a turkey, you have turkey leftovers for like 3 weeks. And it's, you know, just no fun.
Communists.
I know, right? But I was really happy.
Turkey at Thanksgiving.
I was really happy. My parents came to visit, which was a lot of fun. And, you know, we just had a generally awesome time.
From Hawaii?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, they've started coming over here to visit me instead of me going to visit them, because they're awesome like that.
Very convenient.
Yeah, they don't make me get on planes. I'm pretty happy about it.
The less you're on planes, the safer you are.
Well, the less inconvenienced I am.
It's true. TSA isn't bugging you all the time now to take off your shoes.
My parents are way braver than I am. They refuse to go through the backscatter machines that take pictures of you naked. And for reference, backscatter refers to the type of radiation these machines use.
Aha. Uh-huh.
They're actually called, like, body scanners, I think. But my parents refuse to go through them.
I know the common term is body scanner when the news talks about it.
Yeah. And so my parents refuse to go through them and always take the extra time to get wanded down as a statement. And I always say I'm going to do that, and then I don't. Because I'm just, you know, I'm all...
Chicken.
Because I'm just like, you know, this already is a huge pain in the ass. Whatever. But, okay. Also, since last time we have broadcast All Things Trek, we had an awesome session of Star Trek RPG, which I have labeled Gorn Appreciation Day session.
It was really rad. I loved that session. Everyone loved that session.
Yeah, people had a lot of fun. We only had three players, but that was fine. My three players did very well. It was an away team mission where they went over to a damaged Gorn freighter to help it out while their ship went to deal with some convoy somewhere.
So, you know, no backup.
Yeah,
so they needed it most.
So they had no backup. I kind of stole a plot from DS9. Where there was the Klingons were laying mines, and then they got hit by one of their own mines, which my brother totally called. He remembered that episode. He'd seen it. But, you know, the freighter had actually been laying mines and, like, blown a hole in its engine. It took the players a while to figure that out. And it was a lot of fun, because I got to describe, like, what the Gorn do when they're off duty, and, like, their whole relaxation and their culture.
Soft Gorn and their cushy chairs.
Well, because, like, the Gorn are lizards, and lizards lounge around.
They do lounge around. No, it's cool. I was picking up what you were putting down that session.
Yeah,
it's
I know. Just,
now when Gorn and Saltzman are saying I'm a soft Starfleet personnel, you know, officer, I can go, nope, my chairs are worse than yours.
Yep, they have...
my Gorn, duty station is much worse.
The Gorn have big, comfy, heated chairs that they hang out in. And, like, also my favorite part of that episode was that they noticed that the Gorn higher ranks were always physically larger than their subordinates. And so at first they assumed that, like, Gorn ranking system must be based on, like, fisticuffs matches. And, like, it was like, you know, whoever was stronger got the higher rank. And they were like, man, that's dumb. These Gorn are dumb. And then they found out that what it actually is that Gorn, much like crocodiles, don't ever stop growing as they get older. And so the older ones are going to be physically larger than the younger ones.
So how much creative license are you taking with a lot of this stuff? Is this stuff that you're making up?
100%.
Okay.
None of this is from
Because I wasn't sure if you're grabbing it from somewhere like Holotrek or something like that.
No, this is just stuff I made up based on the fact that the Gorn are lizards.
Aha. Uh-huh.
They really, like, and well, I'm sort
space
of...
Space dinosaurs.
Yeah, I'm sort of basing it... Well, they're called dinosaurs, but dinosaurs actually aren't lizards, whereas the Gorn are.
True.
But... Anyway, yeah, I made all this stuff up for the Gorn based on what I think would make a cool species that is not just Klingons 2.0, reptilian this time.
Well, you may actually like, which I finally brought over Star Trek Needs of the Many, which is a Star Trek Online novel I've been saying for several episodes scattered throughout our series that I would bring over and let Oren read. It's actually got a little bit about the baseball match between the Gorn and the Klingons that you can go ahead and read in there.
Yeah, I'm interested to read that. That looks pretty cool.
It's going
to
be rad. You'll love it. You'll love baseball with Gorn. In Klingons.
I'm really excited about tomorrow's session. It's gonna be a lot of fun.
Whatever you do, don't tell me about it.
I'm not gonna.
Until I play.
Well, everyone will hear about it next time.
Hooray! Right,
so for this week, we are talking about the first episode of each series. And I actually went back and rewatched the ones I hadn't seen for a while. Which was a chore for some of them, let me tell you. Because I like Star Trek,
Voyager,
but most
Enterprise.
Of them did not start off good. Even the ones that ended up being good did not. All right, and so before we actually get into the discussion of each one in particular, we talk about a first episode in general. And so, I mean, first of all, you have the difference between a first episode and a pilot. And this is not always...
Do tell.
Well...
Because I don't know what the distinction is.
All right, well, this only actually happens with the original series, but very often what will happen is the people who want to make a show will film an episode and pitch that to the network, and that's the pilot. And sometimes they go on and use the pilot as the first episode of the show.
Just because it's already so cool made and it was good.
The network didn't want to change anything.
Okay.
But very often the pilot is never actually aired because they decide to change it or go in a different direction after network feedback or what have you. And all the Star Trek series, except for the original series, used their pilot as the first episode. But in the original series...
Or at least somewhere, as in the case of TOS.
Well, yeah, in TOS they did eventually air... In TOS, the cage in its entirety was not aired until 1988.
Really?
We had The Menagerie, which was a clip show using clips from the cage as part of the episode, which was actually really cool. I really liked
The
Menagerie.
But really, the cage didn't air until later as a rerun?
1998.
Well, not even a rerun. 1988.
it was aired in 1988, was its original air date.
Wow.
And The Menagerie is actually really cool. It uses a bunch of, clips from the cage to make its own new episode, and because this like no one had seen the cage before, it wasn't like they were just recycling footage that everyone had seen before,
right?
And like, so it wasn't like Shades of Grey from TNG that everyone hated because it was just clips of
footage. Hey everybody, here's a recap of seasons 1 and 2, yeah, featuring Riker.
And it was, you know, so it wasn't like that because no one had seen. And so anyway, the Menagerie is pretty cool, and it's really weird with the original series because when you're trying to pick a first episode, you have The Cage, which was the original pilot.
Right.
Where No Man Has Gone Before, which was the second pilot. And Man Trap, which was the first actual episode that they aired.
Yep.
Because Gene Roddenberry showed the networks The Cage. They rejected it. He, got enough together to make another pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before, which they then accepted, but didn't decide to play. Instead, they made Mantrap. Mm-hmm. And I honestly cannot believe that after rejecting the cage, they accepted Where No Man Has Gone Before, because Where No Man Has Gone Before is awful. It is so bad. Like, the characters are goofy, they are off the wall in, like, how hyper-high energy they are. It's just really weird. You have this reversal of, like, The Cage, which has, like, you know, Michelle Barrett as the lady first officer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little sexist. I mean, you know, Pike makes this reference to how he's not used to having a woman on the bridge because of his yeoman. And he looks, and then, like, the first officer is like, hey. And he looks over and he's like, no offense, you're different. and it's like, oh, ooh, ooh. But at least they have her, and she's, like, competent, and she's the one in charge when Pike's gone.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly in Where No Man Has Gone Before, instead they have, I forget her name, but they have this lady who's supposed to be like a counselor. She's the same actress who plays Houlihan from MASH. And like, they're making all these cracks about...
Is it really?
Yeah, it's totally the same actress.
Huh, interesting.
The TV version, not the movie version.
Right, well, I figured.
And they're making all these cracks about how, like, a professional woman often overcompensates and is cold, and it's just like...
It was the 60s.
It was, but it was, like, it was such a reversal from The Cage. And I can totally believe, according to Leonard Nimoy's book, when Gene Roddenberry was told if he wanted to get his show made, he had to lose... The networks really didn't like the alien, which was Spock, and mm-hmm. the woman first officer.
Right.
And he fought for them, and he was eventually told that he had to lose one. Mm-hmm. And so he decided to keep Spock. But, like, in Where No Man Has Gone Before, Spock is really weird, and he yells all the time for no reason.
And he smiles.
And he smiles.
Oh, wait, no, that's The Cage, I'm sorry.
He only smiles once in The Cage. In The Cage, he's actually much closer to Spock from the series than he really? Is in Where No Man Has Gone Before. Yeah, in The Cage...
I really stiff in The Cage.
Well, he is stiff, but in Where No Man Was Gone Before, he's, like, really over the top and, like, you know, really in your face and, like, really, like, yelly. Like, mm-hmm. He yells a lot. Whereas
he has important things to say, Oren.
In The Cage, he's, like, stiff, but at least he has the whole logic thing going on. He's more thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Where No Man... And then by The Man Trap, they had gotten a much better handle on Spock's character. Except for this one scene in Kirk's quarters where he goes, like, completely off the rails and is screaming at Bones to shoot the alien and, like, beating it in the head with his fists and going, like, oh, I'm gonna get you, alien! And it's...
Wait,
so
Spock was doing that? Or was
yeah,
that
Spock
Kirk?
Was doing that.
Okay.
And that was also the first time we ever saw in Star Trek the patented Star Trek hammer fist where you link your, where you link your fingers together for maximum finger breakage. But, like, you know, Mantrap, all things considered, is a pretty good episode. Like, it's a little weird because, like, they don't ever explain why the alien, which is supposed to be smart and sentient, is, like, so hungry, is, like, so impatient for salt that it just kills a whole bunch of people when it was about to get salt without needing to. Because, like,
Maybe it was on, you know, that, like, edge of starving, you know? Well, like, I can't say I've ever been there. I don't know if you've ever been to that edge of starving, but supposedly the feeling is just so uncontrollable that you have to eat something, well, that you're pretty much, like, try to eat anything.
No, because they actually still had some salt. Because remember, the plot is that the doctor is living with his woman who's supposed to be his wife, but it's actually the alien.
Right.
And he's been feeding he's been feeding it salt tablets. And he shows them their container, and they actually still have some salt tablets left.
Just rationing them.
So, yeah, I imagine he's been rationing them. But they're not completely out. And this alien is supposed to be very smart and is clearly intelligent and can pretend to be McCoy at one point, and can actually talk kind of like McCoy. And it is actually interesting to watch as the alien gets more into McCoy's character the longer it has his form.
Uh-huh.
So I don't understand why an alien that's that smart would decide to start murdering people instead of just waiting for salt.
I think that's more of the kind of the monster movie tropes we were seeing of, you know, the 50s and 60s.
Well, definitely.
Which were a huge success, which I think is probably partly why they went with this episode as the first episode for Star Trek in the beginning, because it was such an awesome hook where it's like, ooh, monsters, ooh.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, everyone loves, you know, monsters killing people, and then, you know, the good guy's going and killing the monster, which is what happened.
Right, and the monster does look really creepy once its form is actually revealed. Yep. It is really scary looking, 60s makeup or no. And it's also, I also have to say that McCoy is a way better doctor than the guy they had in Mantrap. No, excuse me, in the cage.
Wasn't his name, like, Pepper or something?
I forget his name, but he was old, but, like, not in a cool way. Like,
I thought it was something Pepper, which now in my, you know...
Dr. Pepper.
In my mid-20s, I can kind of, like, make the reference of, oh, man, Dr. Pepper. Yeah. Which I think his name was Pepper, I'm not sure.
It might have been, but he was kind of bland. But I actually really liked Pike as the captain. I thought he was cool. He was, like, kind of this... He was sort of, even though he still looks kind of young, he was clearly supposed to be like this kind of grizzled veteran who was having like guilt issues because of all the people that had died under his command, which is way different.
He had a TV in his quarters, too. Hmm? He had a TV in his quarters. Did he? Yeah, he had the knob one.
Oh, okay. That's cool. I didn't notice that.
Which is the only time you ever see another TV is in Voyager.
And thank God that in the Mantrap they managed to get some cool looking phaser props, because man, the props that they have,
the garden hoses, you mean?
Yeah, the props that they have in the cage and in Where No Man Has Come Before looks so dumb, and they're just so weird.
Were they actually phasers? Like, I thought they were called lasers at that point. Still with like the
cage. They might have been called lasers. They might not have invented the word phaser yet.
Yeah.
Although interestingly enough, in Mantrap, when the doctor pulls out a weapon, like not McCoy, but the doctor who is married to the salt thing, he pulls out one of the phaser props from the first from the pilots.
Yes.
So you know, a little bit of prop recycling right there. Also, the uniforms in Mantrap look way cooler than what they had in the cage and in Where No Man Has Gone Before. They made a really good improvement with the uniforms. And in general, I think the effects just look better.
In the cage?
No, in Mantrap.
Okay.
In Mantrap, they made some significant improvements. But in terms of the cage versus Where No Man Has Gone Before, I would watch the cage just for enjoyment. I only watched Where No Man Has Gone Before because
I had to.
It is such a goofy episode, and like Spock has his phaser rifle that looks like a frickin', you know, toilet router, like, you know, something you use.
I love
to
that phaser
out the
rifle, though. No. You can get that in Star Trek Online.
Can you?
Yep.
Why would you want to? Is there something wrong with your plumbing?
No, well, you know, I can't find the bathroom on my starship anywhere, so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily plumbing issues, but, you know.
Yeah, I guess. But I think we got a little off topic, because we ended up jumping right into the original series, but I wasn't quite finished talking about what the first episode is supposed to accomplish, so I guess I'll narrow this down to some bullet points. The first episode...
Well, it's cool. You can close the original series part with this. Mm-hmm.
So the first episode of a show is trying to do is, first and foremost, keep you interested so you will come back to watch it again.
Right.
Because once you've watched two episodes of a show, you are way more likely to watch the third. Mm-hmm. But if you watch one episode, you will very likely not come back if you don't like what you see.
Right.
So the first episode of a show is usually very heavy on special effects, which The Cage was to an extent, and Mantrap definitely was, really heavy on special effects.
Yep.
And they usually dial everything up to 11 in the pilots to try to grab your attention.
Right.
And, you know, they have to give you an idea of what you're going to expect later, And it's so overall, the Mantrap, I think, worked very well in that it showed us that we were going to have, like, they had this, they actually have a debate about whether or not it's morally right to go after this monster, whereas on most television shows of the time, they just would have, you know, grabbed the lasers and gone hunting. And, you know, they try to trick it out, and, like, it is a very intellectual episode, which I think is a pretty good expectation for what we should see later in Star Trek, or at least the good episodes. And Spock has his eyebrows under control, finally, and is... It sets up the dynamic of Spock and Kirk. And one more thing about... Spock, Kirk, and McCoy, excuse me. And also one more thing about Mantrap that was really cool was that Sulu was the second officer. And so when Spock and Kirk are down on the planet, Sulu is in charge and doing, like, cool stuff. And I really liked that. And I got really sad when Sulu was replaced with Scotty. Because, like, after they got Scotty, for some reason, Sulu wasn't in charge anymore when everyone else left. For some reason, it was Scotty. I was like, really? You're going to call the chief engineer up from engineering to sit on the bridge instead of the guy who's already here? That doesn't sound like a good idea.
No, that's the best plan. Don't worry about it.
No.
Engineering can take care of itself.
Yeah. So in general, I think the Mantrap and the Cage both did a pretty good job. I'm still baffled by where no man has gone before, but whatever. all right. So then I had to watch Encounter at Farpoint. And god damn, Encounter at Farpoint is awful.
I love Encounter at Farpoint.
No.
I loved it. No. I loved it because it was so campy.
No.
Yeah.
God, okay. It sounds like
I love it for all the reasons you hate it.
I guess. I mean, to be honest, most of the first season of Next Generation isn't very good. But it's like...
Well, this is about the time where that writer strike was occurring.
Was it?
For a lot of TV, yeah. There's a general writer strike that was going on.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Huh. I thought that was towards the end of season two. No. I thought that was why they made the...
Mm-mm.
Huh.
Because a lot of season one and season two were recycled scripts from TOS, and then ones that were never put on air for TOS.
Yeah,
right. I see a lot of that. This very second episode, The Naked Now,
right,
is just The Naked Time again,
yeah,
right?
It is.
But set in TNG instead.
Okay, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of episodes were actually just straight up done by Gene Roddenberry in the first two seasons.
Yes, they were.
You know, which
history lesson. Everybody.
You know, sorry for saying this, Gene, but you know. They weren't that good.
Well, no. I mean, Gene wasn't a bad writer, but he had a really weird direction he was going with Next Generation, and it just didn't work. He was trying to be very, like, you know, he was trying to go from his whole, like, you know, common understanding in the bonds of men and, like, you know, lack of prejudice that he had in the original series to, like, a really, like, new age, almost back to nature sort of story with the new Next Generation.
Point in case, I don't know if anyone actually remembers this or not, and I'm not actually sure if we talked about this on air or not, or on the recording anyway, that there's supposed to be dolphins in the Enterprise at one point in TNG.
There's actually an episode where Geordi, in the line you can barely hear, is like ushering a Ferengi away from Picard. It's like in the fifth season. I think it might even be The Perfect Mate, or the one with that chrysalis thing that like a woman comes out. But anyway, there's a Ferengi on the ship, and like he's like bothering Picard, and Geordi like tucks him away and like and says like in a line that you have to strain to hear. He says, "Have you seen the dolphins?
Dolphins on the Enterprise."
And it's like, okay, there are dolphins somewhere on the Enterprise.
Oh man, I love it.
But yeah, so there was a whole lot of weird stuff in the first season. But I mean, Encounter at Farpoint, just from a structural standpoint, the pacing is really bad.
Yep.
Like everything is very slow. There's no sense of urgency, even in the situations where the ship is in danger, or when, like, a giant space jellyfish is bombarding the planet.
Well, not even all that aside, we have in the first 10 minutes where they're all abducted by Q, right? Mm-hmm. Well, not all of them, most of them are. Like, Riker's not on board, yeah, Geordi's not on board. And humanity's being put on trial, right?
Yeah.
Like, right then and there. And, you know, that's cool. Don't worry about it, guys.
No, it'll be fine. And then, like, in the very first
part, and they have a timetable they have to work off too, mm-hmm. for that, from what I recall.
Yep. And the very first part is like Picard gives this super long ass log entry, which all of that information is then established by characters on screen.
Yep.
So you can skip the log entry and still know exactly what's going on.
Yep.
And it's like, why is that log entry even there? It's just to pad out the story, which would totally make sense if there was a writer's strike. Maybe that's what it's for.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, for some reason, everything looks way goofier than it did in the original series. I mean, the original series is goofy, don't get me wrong, but, like, the uniforms are, like, super skin-tight, what I like to call junk-tight, you know?
Yep.
They're tight enough, you know, and like, the coloring is really weird. like...
I mean just the general decor?
Yeah, the general decor, especially down on the planet, the decor is very strange.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I thought that was supposed to be, like, a weird alien culture thing, but no, that's supposed to be a Starfleet base.
Like, no, the aliens... it's not. Hmm? It's not a Starfleet base.
Well, no, it was built to look like a Starfleet base. That's what the aliens built it to look like.
Really?
Yeah, they or they supposedly built it. We find out later it's actually a space jellyfish.
Well, yeah, space jellyfish is what it is. But my understanding was that they had just built, or tried to build, you know, air quotes build, mind you, since we're talking space jellyfish here, you know, just a base that where all needs would be accommodated. It wasn't necessarily supposed to be built to be...
I was pretty sure they slipped in a line about how it was built to Federation specifications.
I thought it was supposed to accommodate Starfleet.
Okay, well, maybe it wasn't. But anyway, it still looked very strange.
It did.
and, like, the characters don't really work. Like, Picard is just this really grumpy old man.
I love Riker. Picard in the first season. First season, Picard's the best.
No! You know, Riker is really bland. Tasha, of course, overacts to everything. Because, and again, this isn't the actor's fault. This is what they were told to do.
I think it is.
You think who? You think
it's Denise Crosby. I think
what?
That is...
No. Oh, yeah. My God, no. Yeah. I will fight you.
You will fight me?
I have a screwdriver in my hand from when you were cleaning out my computer. I will fight you.
Part of the reason she left is because she felt her character wasn't getting a whole lot of love.
Well,
right, and she wanted her character to get more love, is what it was. More love from the writers, and...
Well, she's
right. There
are
a few of them that there are. And no, I agree with that point, but... It becomes very obvious that the way she's portraying to portray her character, being kind of more over the top.
No, I think that what it was that she left because her character was so over the top and wasn't getting any real development. Especially if you look at the way she plays her character.
So you think she was being told to act it that
way?
Yeah,
I think that's how she was being directed. And it makes it especially holds up if you look at the way she acts in Yesterday's Enterprise and in... All Good Things, when she's playing Tasha. Even in All Good Things, she's playing Tasha from the same time period. And she acts way different and is way more way more reserved and acts like a regular person instead of this, like, hyper ball of energy that's going to explode at the slightest provocation.
Uh-huh.
And I've seen Denise Crosby in other things and she doesn't act like that.
That's just her character probably got love in those things.
Probably, but...
I haven't seen her in anything else.
I just think compared to... I mean, if you just look at it, you have Bland Riker, Grumpy Picard, Worf being a complete idiot, trying to shoot the window because Q's face is on it. It's like, given all that, I honestly don't think that has anything to do with Denise Crosby. I think that was just what Tasha Yar was told to act like, because I think that's what they wanted her to be. She was supposed to be passionate, but, like, they were just giving her all these terrible lines and probably bad direction. And I think that if she'd survived past the end of the first season, we would have seen her change significantly. And I think, like we did with Picard and Riker and Worf, I think they would have... Well, Worf to a lesser extent, maybe. And I think we would have seen a much more interesting character. Now, of course... But that's a whole other debate for another time. another time, another place. And, of course,
I'll concede because you have a screwdriver in your hand.
I do. but the point, the main reason Encounter at Farpoint really fails is that it doesn't actually give us any idea of what we're going to see that is going to be anything we'll want to see later. It does, and Next Generation, later seasons of Next Generation are nothing like Encounter at Farpoint because they realized it was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, if the Next Generation hadn't been a follow up to Star Trek, Encounter at Farpoint probably would have killed it. I don't think anyone would have watched it after that. I think it would have died at the end of the first season.
Mm-hmm.
But fortunately, it didn't, because then we got, once they got into season 3, they got a new writer, they got Michael Piller on board and really hit their stride. And everything got better. So, despite it not being very good, at least...
When do you think TNG actually did get better?
When did it get better? Yeah, well, it was marginally better
for
in season
me,
2.
It was, I feel it got better about a quarter of the way through season 3. Is when it really started mm-hmm. to take off, I feel.
What was the, I have a hard time remembering the order of episodes in season 3 because they're all out of sync.
You have Evolution, and then, which is the one about nanites that we see with Wesley Crusher's high school experiment or whatever it is.
Yeah.
He's trying to do something with nanites. And then it's Ensigns of Command, where Data goes down to the planet with the radiation, with that the Sheliak is like, oh my gosh, there's humans on this planet.
I really like that episode.
That episode too.
I have no idea why it's called Ensigns of Command. But I really like it.
Yeah, I really don't know either. After that, I'm really sure. But it was about a quarter of the way through, which I think it's Who Watches the Watchers, I think, was my first favorite out of mm-hmm. season 3. And then from then on, it just starts to get better.
Yeah.
I mean, as well as we get to, the end of season 6, it starts to, go downhill, obviously.
Well, at the end of season 6, it started to slow down because they weren't really sure what they were doing anymore because they'd already done so much.
Yep. Then DS9 was out at that point as well, so a lot of focus was being put on DS9, and then upcoming Voyagers was supposed to come out the year after.
Speaking of Deep Space Nine, Emissary is by far my favorite of the starting
episodes. I really like Emissary, too.
Emissary is really good. You know, it's not perfect. They've still got... Well, first of all, Garak's not in it. What?
I'm not concerned about that, really. As much as I like Garak, it's okay that he's not the first episode.
And there are some rough spots. Like, Quark's makeup is a little weird-looking compared to what he'll look like later. And
yeah,
like,
it was really kind of more this area where his nose and mouth were kind of weird.
And, like, they made him look more bestial in the first episode.
They did.
In Emissary. And then, like, Odo... Like, they clearly didn't have a very good handle on Odo's character in the first episode. Like, he comes off as kind of, like... I don't know. It's hard to get a grasp on what he's up to. Like, you know, in the later episodes, you find out that he's, you know, he's very reserved and very stoic, but he has a very strong sense of justice.
Yep.
And he has a very strong character in terms of, like, you know, he will not do the wrong thing for the right reasons, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas in the first episode, all I kind of got from him was that he was really kind of grumpy, you know, Picard style. And I got that he didn't like Starfleet. I didn't entirely get why.
I didn't get the sense he was grumpy. I got the sense, and this is very apparent also in the, well, maybe not so apparent, but to me it was anyway, in the Kira character in the first episode, was that everyone was very much used to doing things a certain way. Because when the Cardassians were around, you know, especially probably Odo, since he was chief of security on the station, at that time, you know, he had pretty much set in the way he wanted to take care of things. It was very evident with the way he handled that that thief. I don't know what the alien race is called.
Right, the guy with the mace.
Yeah, the guy with the freaking like aerial flail mace
thing. Yeah, he tried to,
which is a really cool weapon. I gotta admit.
Yeah, I really liked how I really wanted to see someone like try to punch Odo and have Odo just kind of turn into gelatin and have the guy's fist like lodge in his chest.
No, man,
I thought that would have been funny. And I have to say, in the first episode, I was also really confused why Odo was even still around, because they were like, he was the chief of security under the Cardassians. I was like, wait a minute, didn't the Bajorans hate the Cardassians?
Yeah,
why is he still around?
Wouldn't they make him a collaborator?
Yeah, well, they finally got around to explaining it later, but at first it was really weirding me out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really understand it. But, I mean, overall, especially, I think Emissary gives us the best idea of what to expect from later in the show, because... You know, we have it sets up the Cardassians as villains, and we have that really cool standoff between the Cardassians and the main characters, particularly because the Cardassian commander is actually not an idiot. He's actually fairly intelligent. And when the characters throw up their illusion of super weapons, he's like, nah, that can't be real.
I thought it was a really good sense of continuity too from TNG.
Yeah, exactly.
When, you know, one, obviously Picard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Picard's doing, you know, the whole trying to set up, you know, administration here thing, you know, with Sisko and whatnot. Then we had, as you said, the Cardassian commander, I think Gullivec was his name, later on. Wait, no. Gullivec was actually in a Maquis episode later on, wasn't he?
He was in the first episode of Voyager, actually.
Was he?
Yeah, he was.
Really?
He's the guy who is chasing the Maquis ship in the beginning.
Okay.
It's totally Gullivec.
Gotcha. Well, even more continuity there. But we'll get to Voyager later.
Yeah, don't worry. We will.
But, I mean, not just the first episode, obviously, of DS9, but sprinkled throughout DS9, there was a great sense of continuity from TNG to DS9, you know, giving a great sense that, you know, this was, in fact, all one universe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just something that's happening here while the Enterprise is off doing other things.
Exactly. Well, I mean, in preparation for DS9, you know, the Next Generation had a couple of Bajoran episodes.
They did.
And, of course, as a lot of people may already know, Kira was originally just supposed to be Ro'Laren. Originally, Ro'Laren was going to leave the ship with O'Brien and become the DS9's first officer, but Michelle Forbes wasn't interested.
She didn't want to do a series at the time.
Yeah, well, she doesn't ever want to do series.
Really?
Michelle Forbes is really kind of, has a number of times shown up and been a guest star, but, like, she won't sign up to be in series. That's just not a thing that she does.
She ever said why?
She just doesn't want to be typecasted, I assume. You know, if you be in a series for 8 years, that's something people are going to know you for.
It's true.
And she just wants to be able to do what she wants. But anyway, like, you know, and when they first introduced Kira, even though I like Kira a lot, there is sort of this character is kind of familiar. I think I remember this character. This character was on TNG, like, last episode.
I know this person.
I
see what you did.
Yeah. But even so, I still like Kira. I'm glad that they went with Kira. I think she and Sisko have a better dynamic than Ro and Sisko could have had.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it would have been
in that particular case, because Kira was not Starfleet.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, for one, because, I mean, if they had put, you know, all Starfleet all the time in charge, the only person you would have on the quote-unquote senior staff would have been Odo at that point. Then we'd have Odo and Kira now at this point.
Yeah, especially because even though Ro was Bajoran, she wasn't actually raised on Bajor. Like, she was raised in a refugee camp.
She was in
a
refugee camp somewhere.
So, like, we wouldn't have had any main characters who knew what the hell was going on Bajor. Mm-hmm. Like, because... like, Bajor had all of its really... it had its own, like, internal politics going on.
Oh, yeah.
And fortunately, we had Kira, who was an insider who knew what was going on, so we could see it all through her eyes. But if we had Ro, Bajor would have been this giant enigma that none of us would have understood, mm-hmm. because we wouldn't have known what was going on in it. I am really glad they went with Kira. And then, of course, we have the scene where they first discover the wormhole, which is awesome, and the prophets. I really love the way the prophets portray themselves. That is just such a cool idea. Because, mm-hmm. you know, it saves money, and it looks awesome. Because they don't have to come up with these, like, weird special effects. No, the prophets just look like people that you know, but, like, all creepy-like.
Mm-hmm. Outside of time.
Yeah, outside of time, which is weird. The prophets being outside of time is strange, because the prophets both understand and don't understand linear time, because... they don't understand it because Sisko hasn't explained it to them yet, but they do because they're timeless and they made Sisko exist, as is revealed in a later episode. So whatever.
Oh dear, I've gone cross-eyed.
Yeah, we've officially crossed the streams. And there's a lot of character growth just with Sisko. It like is a good way. It invests us in Sisko's character. We get to see the Battle of Wolf 359, which was incidentally the last time we ever saw an Ambassador class ship on television.
Not true.
Not true?
No, we see them in the background several times during DS9.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Nah.
Totally.
Nah, bro.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. All right.
They're there, I promise you. I don't know what episodes they're in. I mean, you're the one who's got the hard-on for the Ambassador, not me.
Yeah, I know, and I'm pretty...
I love me the Excelsior. The Excelsior you see everywhere.
Yeah, you do. I'm pretty sure that's the last time you see the Ambassador, is
in full shots, yes. Where, obviously, because it does that swooping motion towards the cube and fires phasers to no effect and whatnot. But it is in several background shots when you were just kind of panning around the station in DS9.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't believe it, but all right. I'll talk to my friend Jim. He's watching through all of it right now.
It's true. Our friend Jim is.
He takes a lot of pleasure with yelling at me about things he doesn't like.
And I love his Facebook status.
Because he knows it hurts me that when he criticizes my favorite show. But, you know, I got to learn to take it because I dish it out enough.
He has silly Facebook statuses, too, on that stuff.
All right. So anyway, Deep Space Nine, awesome. All right. Voyager. Not so much. I think
Quark was probably the best thing that came out of the Voyager
pilot. Yeah, it was. The scene with Quark in it. You know, actually, I had forgotten. Like, I watched Caretaker again, like, the other day, and I had forgotten a lot of stuff. I remembered not liking it, but I couldn't really remember why, and now I do, and it's really bizarre. Caretaker's problem is that it is really badly storyboarded. There are a whole lot of transitions that don't make any sense. Like, my favorite one is the one where they're like, we don't know how to get to the Ocampa City. Suddenly, in the next scene, they're in the Ocampa City with, like, no explanation of how they got there. Like, Kes said that she was going to help them, but, like, we already know they can't just beam right into the Ocampa City. They already established that later, so it's like, wait, how did you get here? Did you walk?
That's how I thought they did it. Is that because she knew how to get back to the surface, right? So she knew what access levels were available.
So like they climbed down, but like then they would have run into Torres and Kim, who were busy climbing up.
Well, there were several shafts, from what I understood.
Were there? I mean, it seemed to me that there was only one. Like Kes only seemed to know about one. And then they talk about how there's this. They mention offhand that there's this colony of people who have left the city, but. Haven't, because we haven't heard of this colony, and it's like, is it on the surface? Is it somewhere else underground? There's some medicine that comes from it, so it must not be on the surface, but we never actually see this colony or what anyone
there
is.
They say it's on a planet still, though?
They say it's a colony.
And they say it's a colony, because, I mean, there were the other Ocampa on the other.
That's not who they're talking about.
Okay.
They can't be who they're talking about. and then, like, at the end of the episode, they never addressed if Torres and Kim were cured of that horrible disease they got from the caretaker. It's like, you know, because
The Ocampa didn't treat them, did they?
Nope. The Ocampa didn't know how to treat them. They were very clear on that. And that everyone else who had gotten the disease at that point had died.
Okay.
And suddenly, and they never, like, resolve it. And they're just, you know, it's just, they're just cured in the next episode. They don't even get, like, a log entry with the doctor saying he cured them. Or how he would have cured them. and it's like there's just all this stuff, and it's and then suddenly and like it gets even worse than that. It's like so like the array they throw offhand that for some reason the array is in like a neighboring star system to the Acampa mm-hmm. instead of in the same one, but like they seem to be able to traverse that distance in like 2 seconds. Because, like, the ship is in orbit of the Ocampo planet, and then suddenly it's back at the array, and there's, like, no travel time. Hmm. And it's like, wait a minute, how close together are they?
And then the Namor system is really close.
But even if it was really close, it would still take a couple of minutes. and then there's, like, suddenly Janeway at the end is like, Tuvok, prepare the tri-cobalt devices. What's a tri-cobalt device? They've never mentioned a tri-cobalt device
it's
before.
It's a cobalt times three.
They don't tell... Yeah, I guess it's three cobalt atoms fused together. It's like, what the hell is a tri-cobalt device? And it's not just like, hey Tuvok. It's not like a throwaway line of technobabble where it's like, Tuvok, like, throw together an explosive that I call a tri-cobalt. It's like, they specifically have them. It's mm-hmm. like the tri-cobalt devices. And so it's like, wait, is that just a thing that ships have now? They look like torpedoes to me. Why didn't she just say, shoot it with torpedoes? I assume that's what they were.
The tri-cobalt warhead is supposed to be much more destructive.
Yeah, well, we know that.
Why the science? I don't know.
We know either. That now because of like, you know, the extended universe. Well, it's not really the extended universe, but we know that now because of, like, you know, Star Trek Online and, like, tech manuals and background info. But at the time that the episode was released, it was like, what's a tri-cobalt device?
Super secret thing.
And then it's like, even, of course, then it brings up the question of, why didn't you shoot the tri-cobalt device at that ship that was kicking your ass?
This Seven brings this up in an episode. Oh, man, I don't remember the name of the episode, but she had that extra cortical processor thingamajig that she made for her alcove
to allow her
to process a bunch of data. And she even raises the same point. Why do we have tri-cobalt devices on this thing?
And, like, do they have more? I mean, do they only have two? Because they only fired two. Were there more of them somewhere?
There's supposed to be, like, two or three on there.
And, like, you know, why didn't they shoot them at the giant Kazon ship that was kicking their ass? Even even more importantly, they have, like, this weird... they just have all of these weird transitions and, like... Then, like, you know, of course, there's the really infamous scene where, like, Neelix takes them down to meet the Kazon, and then, like, for no reason, like, as negotiations are finally getting started, for no reason pulls out his phaser and holds the Kazon leader at gunpoint, and is like, let's transport out of here now that I'm, and grabs Kes and is like, let's transport out.
Well, his whole thing was that he was using Janeway and the crew to get Kes back.
Right, but, like, And I understand that happened, and of course it does make... It's pretty obvious that they could have gotten Kes back without doing that, but whatever, Neelix is stupid. The part about it that's weird is that, like, Janeway doesn't at any point try to apologize to the Kazon, or be like, you know, hey, that wasn't actually us, this was this person that you also don't like. She never tries to patch up relations.
It's true she doesn't, but this is also her first command...
Yeah.
Ever, and now she's in a situation where they're, you know, across the galaxy.
And, like, then, of course...
When did they actually figure that out? That was... Kim had said that.
Yeah, they figured that out before they even got sucked over to the array.
Yeah, okay.
And then, of course, there's the, there's this throwaway line that the Kazon leader has where he's like, I've tried every means of persuasion I know, and he's talking about Kes to try to get her to tell him where the Ocampa City is and how to get to it.
And she's pretty beat up.
Well, she's got, like, a black eye and, like, a bloody lip.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, all right, so... Either this guy is really unimaginative, or Kes has been horribly tortured and probably raped, and she is fine. She just completely bounces back from it. We don't ever have any kind of trauma rehabilitation. And, like, then it raises the question of, wait a minute, Kes was captured the moment she got to the surface, but, like, she's Neelix's girlfriend. How did she become Neelix's girlfriend? Where did they meet? When did they have time to meet? Because she was captured the moment she got to the surface.
You know, Delta Quadrant online personal ads.
I guess. I mean, the only thing... Like, really what it sounded like was that Neelix was trading with these Kazon, saw their, like, slave girl, and was like, that's hot, I want to tap that. And, like, didn't actually know anything about Kes, and that Kes is, like, so horribly traumatized by this point that, like, any person who doesn't immediately begin beating her, she, like, latches onto. And it's just like, oh my god, this is so terrible.
This puts a totally different... view on this whole relationship that
really
I had never considered before.
And it's awful. But that doesn't seem to be what the episode is going with it. That just is, like, just what I came up with based on watching it. But assuming that's not actually what they mean, the Kazon leader actually seems very reasonable and is like, you know, hey, I'd like to trade for your replicator technology. And you notice that at first, Janeway The reason Janeway says that it wouldn't work isn't because they're not allowed to trade the technology, but because it's integrated with the ship. And so, you know, it's clear that they can actually get somewhere with this guy, and then, like, and then, of course, when they meet him again, he's, like, doesn't trust them because they betrayed him and pointed a gun at him during a peaceful negotiation.
Yeah,
but Janeway's all confused as to why the Kazon don't trust them, and is like, you're so ridiculous, sir! You are unreasonable! And then it's just so strange. And then, like, in the final, like, in the final sequence where, like, the caretaker is dying, and Janeway supposedly has the option to send them home using the array, which they completely ignore the fact that more Kazon ships are supposed to be on their way. There are still two more out there. Voyager is beat to shit. The Maquis ship has been destroyed.
Because they went kamikaze
on the big ship. And for all we know, there are more ships coming. One of them could be a big ship. We don't know.
Yep.
And Tuvok says that it will take several hours for to make the array send them home. And it's like, really, they had an easy out. They could have just been like, we don't have time for that. The Kazon will be here soon with reinforcements, and we can't fight them. Because, you know, this is before we'd established that the Kazon were about as capable as a wet paper bag.
yep.
And they could have just used that, but instead Janeway was talking about it like it was a moral issue as opposed to a practical one. And it's really weird to watch. And of course, this brings up the obvious, the thing that this really brings up is, wait a minute, if Tuvok can use these systems, and Tuvok can operate the thing that sends them home, why can't he operate the station's weapons?
Yeah, the array is armed.
Yeah,
we know that because they're shooting at the planet.
The array is crazy armed. The Kazon stay away from it like the plague, because it would murder them.
Uh-huh.
So why doesn't he just turn on the guns and be like, all right, anyone want to come near the station? No, I don't think so. I don't think you want that. I got this giant green gun.
Starfleet isn't ready to go fisticuffs in the Delta Quadrant quite yet.
Yeah.
But they're totally ready to provoke people into fisticuffs later.
Yeah, well, I mean, they, you know, are having a big fight with the Kazon outside. And, of course, the other thing I wondered was that, like, you see, like, first of all, and, like, Voyager gets all beat to hell when they get transported across the galaxy, right? Like, their warp core is about to breach. Like, a good fourth of their crew is dead.
Uh-huh.
The Maquis ship seems to have come through without a scratch.
Well, the Maquis ship had been there for a while already, so they had time to repair their stuff.
But, like, I mean, they had been there for, I guess they had been there for a little while, but, like,
I mean, because I don't remember what the exact time
was.
No,
they hadn't been. They were all on the array.
Were they?
Yeah, all of the Maquis and Tuvok were on the array that entire time. So they didn't have any time to repair.
Because I thought the initial brief was that Voyager was tasked with finding that ship, particular ship,
right,
because Tuvok was on it.
Right, and it had been,
and they'd been out of contact for like a week or two.
Several days. Not a week, it was several days.
Huh, okay.
But they go over to the array, and they're all there. They're all, the Maquis and Tuvok are all on the array in stasis, or unconscious somehow. And so unless they got there, fixed their ship while hanging around this array, and then got teleported to the array, the implication was pretty clear that they'd been on the array the whole time, so they had no time to fix their ship, but apparently it was fine. I mean, frankly, I think it should have come apart, but... and then, of course, there's the other weird thing about this is that Voyager has been really damaged, and then, like, in the next scene, it's completely fine. And it's like, how did you do all these repairs? When did you have time to fix all this stuff? There was, like, wires and rocks coming out of the walls. And,
I do enjoy the panels, you know, full of rocks. They
and,
explode.
Like, half the panels had come off the walls, and everything was on fire, but now it's all fixed. How? There are just all these really...
Bioneural gel, it's okay.
Yeah, all these really rough, like, scene transitions. And it's just so strange. And then, of course, there's just the parts that are just stupid. Like, the part at the end where Neelix comes in and is like, I want to stay on your ship. And he claims to have all these skills that he's never actually demonstrated at all. And you know, and Janeway's like looking at him kind of flabbergasted and then agrees. And another part that I was really confused was that I'm pretty sure, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that in the second episode, Neelix converts the captain's dining room into a mess hall. I'm positive
into
that
into a cooking area is what it is. He converts that into the kitchen.
Right.
Because you have the main galley mess hall area, right, which is where the rest of the crew eats. And then you have right next door there is, you know, her private mess.
Okay.
Is what it is. And then he just converts that entire thing into a kitchen area.
Okay, that makes a little more sense.
Because there's that serving bar, and he had to knock out part of that wall and all that stuff, so.
Okay, that makes a little more sense. I was really confused. I remember him converting the captain's dining room, and then but then in the first episode, they're all eating in the mess hall, and I was like, wait, doesn't the mess hall exist yet? Neelix hasn't converted it yet, what?
No, I really enjoy the idea of that entire mess hall area being just the captain's
mess. Well, that's what I thought it was at first, because that's what they made it sound like. And I was like, god damn, the captain needs a lot of space to eat dinner.
Whoever designed the Intrepid class, fail, if that's the captain's mess. That's a lot of space, man. Mm-hmm.
And they have, like...
No, it was just, like, this small, mm-hmm. smaller room, probably about the size of your living room, which is, like, a 20 by 15 area.
Right. And, like, and then, of course, there's, like, some really just weird blocking. Like, my favorite is when, right before the wave hits Voyager to teleport them to the Delta Quadrant, you see the first officer, like, take a run across the bridge, and he has this really weird expression on his face. But, like, where is he running to? Because he's standing...
Because they're bracing for impact.
But yeah, he's told to brace for impact. He's standing behind the seats where the captain and the first officer sit with his hands on the rails.
Mm-hmm. And suddenly he sprints around
the
rail.
Off the rail and runs around. And at first you think he's running to his chair. He's not. He's running in completely the wrong direction to get to his chair.
Mm-hmm. So he's like, running towards the helm.
Yeah, he's like running towards the helm, but there's already someone sitting at the helm.
Yep.
I don't know if he was thinking he was going to like wrestle her off the chair and take the seat for himself.
You out! I need a seat!
Which, of course, wouldn't have helped because she ended up dying anyway.
The chair offline.
And the chair didn't have any seatbelts. Also, my favorite thing was that at one point they dropped that Voyager's cruising speed, or like maximum cruising speed, was like 9.975. And correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, usually a cruising speed indicates a speed that a ship can maintain for a long period of time.
That's correct.
So what is Voyager's top, like, actual speed? How fast can they go for short periods of time?
I don't know. Voyager is weird. Remember Threshold?
I do remember Threshold.
I mean, working with stuff like that, all bets are off.
I remember the newts. I can't ever I can't ever forget the newts.
I don't think we'll ever forget the newts.
No one will. So yeah, like I had forgotten just how bad Caretaker was, and just how weirdly storyboarded it is.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my goodness. Oh, also, my favorite part is that they very clearly explain in Caretaker that the Ocampa have at least some psychic abilities. They can communicate telepathically with each other. But Kes mentions that there are, like, stories about how they supposedly used to be able to do way more.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, when Kes is trying to unlock her mental abilities, they talk about it like they don't have any. Like she's starting completely from scratch. And it's like, wait a minute, weren't they already telepathic?
The analysis I would draw with that, or the comparison, excuse me, not the analysis, would be, you ever seen the movie Unbreakable, M. Night Shyamalan?
M. Night Shyamalan? Yeah. No, I have not.
All right, so Unbreakable is about, has Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, and it's about superheroes, but set today. So, like, there's some people who are, you know, physically bigger, stronger, can have a higher pain threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in this case, is Bruce Willis' character, which he's, like, the superhero of the story. And then there's Samuel Jackson's character, was at the other end of the spectrum, which they're weaker. He has, like, glass bone disease, or I don't remember what it's called, but, you know, his bones break really easily because they're so brittle.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, misstepping off a curb will break his ankle.
And that's Samuel L. Jackson's character?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, well, anyway.
Okay.
So, it's kind of like, you know, it's like a myth for the Ocampa, for instance, in the same way like superheroes are for us,
mm-hmm.
you know, in today's society, right? Where there are people who are physically, you know, stronger or smarter or so, where there's other people on the other end of the spectrum that aren't. In the case of, like, the Ocampa, they had heard stories about this kind of stuff, right?
Well, no, that part I understand. It was just weird that, like, they never try to, like, bring out her... They never try to use the psychic power she already has, which is the ability to telepathically communicate. Like, that never comes up. That's never a thing that she and Tuvok ever work on. They're always working on, like, telekinesis.
Maybe they did
it
off-screen and didn't work or something like that.
I don't know. They're always talking
about
because
she could obviously do it with other Ocampa, mm-hmm. as we saw in the one where they're at the array or whatever.
Right.
So they can obviously do that. But it may be just that, you know, those are stories and there was some latent potential there. They never obviously developed it on the planet where she originally came from there with, you know, the Kazon and whatnot there because the caretaker was just pampering them.
Yeah, he was.
So, which, I mean, if you're pampered, you have no real reason to try to grow or develop at all, because all your needs are taken care of.
Okay. All right, well, that's fair enough. All right, so, Voyager, so, I mean, like, and I guess...
That being said, Caretaker's still terrible.
Yeah, it is. Especially with the whole, like, you know, the Maquis, like, immediately integrate in with the crew, and it's really weird, because up until that point, like, the Maquis have been having, like, like, you know, really have been having like a lot of friction with the Federation, with the Starfleet crew, and then suddenly at the end it's like, we've decided that the Maquis are going to integrate with the Starfleet crew, and it's like, you know, it's like, wait, what? Like, even at the end of the first episode, it's like, what, huh? Where did this come from?
Well, there are more Starfleet than there are Maquis.
Right, but
despite the Maquis ship having, like, what, 70 people on it?
50 people, like, crammed
in. Yeah, it's this tiny little ship, just a ton of people in it. It's like, oh my gosh, what a sardine can.
I know, right? And there's also, like, there's this hilarious moment where the part where Chakotay is on the stairway that's collapsing, and, like, but the part that finally falls out, off as he and Paris make their, like, daring escape isn't the part that Chakotay was on. It's, like, another part of the stairway. And it's like, wait, so Chakotay was actually fine? He wasn't
no
actually...
No actual danger. It's okay.
He wasn't actually in any danger. I guess he would have... Like, it was, like, a connecting piece between his part of the stairway and the rest. So, like, he would have had to, like, you know, climb over the gap kind of carefully. But he actually would have been fine.
Well, his leg was busted.
Yeah, it was. And you have, of course, you had Paris there making all kinds of Indian jokes.
Can't you turn into a bird and fly us away? No, wrong
which,
tribe.
Which I thought, no, it was the first one was that if I save you, your life belongs to me. That for then he was like, wrong tribe.
Oh.
And then he was like, can't you turn into a bird? And he was like, you're too heavy. And I thought Chakotay was taking that pretty well in stride.
Considering.
I think if Paris came up and started giving me that kind of shit, I'd have smacked him.
Broken leg, or no.
Throwing him right off that stairwell.
I don't need you, because I can be a bird, because you're too heavy.
Yep, if I didn't have you, I'd turn into a bird. Speaking of birds, Enterprise. Alright, so Broken Bow, which is also really bad. Although, on rewatching, not actually as bad as Caretaker, I have to say. At least Enterprise is properly storyboarded. It doesn't have these weird scene transitions that make no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, everything kind of flows from one scene to the other. Granted, these are all bad scenes, but at least they actually fit. And, of course, the immediate thing that will jump out at you about the Enterprise episodes is how they have taken the Vulcans, and they have decided that the Vulcans, instead of being emotionally reserved and, you know, being very calm and logical, they are just super passive-aggressive. That's what the Vulcans are in Enterprise. They are...
Well, they aren't pacifists yet, anyway.
No.
For one. I mean, they're logical and they won't, you know, try and initiate or provoke anyway. At least from what we can tell, you know, because that's what we understand of Vulcans from, you know, TNG, DS9, Voyager, yeah. All that stuff, right? Because later on in the series, T'Pau hasn't done her stuff yet, right? Remember that whole series? That whole mess of stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like a whole different, like, societal change that happens for the Vulcans there.
Right.
But I mean, up until this point, we actually have, like, a high command and stuff, like, an actual military, like, infrastructure in place.
Well,
like, the Vulcans are pretty militant at this point, I think.
Well, they had a space force, which is something that they needed. I mean, they didn't need one afterwards, because Starfleet, you know, was sort of, became the homogenized Federation fleet. But,
well,
like,
Federation
I mean,
wasn't even a thing until 10 years later.
Right, but, like, I mean, they have their big society.
I mean, T'Pau was doing her things, like, 3 years after this episode.
Well, like, they have their societal changes later, but they still have a military after that. Because they need one, because they're surrounded by people who hate them.
Yeah, well, it's a scaled-back military, though, from what we have.
It's the same size. Because she
dismantled a whole bunch of it.
What? No, they just had
that's why it's...
They just had to restructure the high command. Like, they didn't dismantle the military. I've watched all these episodes. This didn't happen.
So have I. Yes, it did. It totally did.
No, it did not.
Yeah, it did. Because Archer, in a later episode, after all that stuff, after Archer, you know, hauls rocks to the desert and all that good stuff, right? Later, an episode later, he's saying that they need help from the Vulcans for something or some other thing. I don't remember what it was exactly.
Yeah, and what T'Pau says is that their military isn't well organized because they're restructuring the high command. I remember this, what you're talking about, and that's how T'Pau explains it. It's not that they just suddenly decided to scrap a whole bunch of their ships, because that would be stupid. It would be stupid,
but we're talking about Enterprise.
Right. But anyway, the point is that the Vulcans, it isn't that, like, the Vulcans just as a race at this point are really bitchy. Like, that's the best way to describe the Vulcans, is that they're super passive-aggressive, and they're just, like...
I think they have much more of a military agenda at this point.
But it's not a military agenda, it's just the way they express themselves. Like, you know how, like, Spock, when he didn't approve of something, he's like, you know, he would tell you he disapproves of it. Oh, I forgot to mention this, speaking of Vulcans, the ray of sunshine from Caretaker is that Tim Ross is actually a really good Vulcan. And
I'm glad we got something good out of
Vulcan. I really wish that Tim Russ had been on another show as a Vulcan, because he's really good. And he actually gets some good dialogue. But in Enterprise, the Vulcans are... And again, we hadn't found out anything more about what happened later. All we know in Broken Bow is that we see all these Vulcans, And they're all just really, really mean. And it's, like, for reasons we can't really get. But, like, and they just, the way that they act is just, I can think of a number of people that act like that. And it's just like, this is an entire race of people that act like this. Their philosophy is passive aggressiveness. And it's just, it's really weird. And then, of course, the humans, by contrast, are really stupid. Especially Archer and his whole, like, Archer is just really afraid of authority in the first episode. Like, he refuses to contact Starfleet because he's worried they'll give him orders to stop his really stupid quest.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, very little in Broken Bow, like, is intelligent at all. Like, my favorite part is when they're trying to teach Tucker how to fly the alien pod. And Tucker's a terrible pilot. And it's like, wait, did you not have anyone else on the ship who could fly this thing? I mean, even if you didn't, Archer's a better pilot than Tucker. And Archer is in the pod with him. It's like, why is Tucker flying it? Like, we know Archer's a better pilot than Tucker. And, like, the funny part is that Mayweather says he could fly it. But they're like, no, we need you here, Mayweather. But, like, all that the ship does is sort of fly back and forth in circles. Whereas, well, it's being blown up. So, really, they needed their chief engineer and not their pilot.
Yep.
And there is this really...
Poor resource management.
Yeah, well, that's a fact. And then, of course, there's that hilarious sequence where the crew is, like, stumbling around trying to investigate a spaceport. And, like, the only people who managed to not get captured...
Something to go with the planet on Rigel, right?
Yeah. The only people who managed to not get captured are like, Reed and Mayweather, and that's only because they were so bad at investigating that they, like, investigated some red herrings for a while, and then they got bored and went back to the shuttle pod. And that's, like, the only reason they didn't get captured.
We got bored.
And, like, there's, like, a firefight going on right outside, and they make a comment about how you don't see lightning in snowstorms very often, but it doesn't look like lightning. You can see out the window that laser beams are flying back and forth.
It's alien lightning, Orin, and it's cool.
Yeah, I guess
they know exactly what alien lightning looks like.
I guess
it is. It's snowstorms.
And then, of course, there's that even weirder looking scene where, like, a ship flies over the dock, and, like, T'Pol suddenly gets, like, hurled across the deck.
That's from the thrust of the engine thrust.
Yeah, I know that it's supposed to be, but it doesn't disturb any of the snow around her. It just hurls her across
the
deck.
It's anti-disturbing snow thrusters.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
Okay, that's cool, handy. Bro. Yeah, I mean, I get the intention, but it just looks really weird. And then, of course, there's the really weird, like, character arc that Archer has, where he's, like, really mad at the Vulcans for his father not being able to finish his engine, but because the Vulcans were holding out on them. But, like, if the Vulcans had told Archer's dad how to make the engine, it wouldn't have been Archer's dad's engine. It would have been the Vulcans' engine that he was building.
Engine. Yep.
And so it's like, really, Archer? You don't see this obvious thing? Don't? No, not at all? Okay, whatever. And of course, there's the worst part of the episode is...
Well, it's frustrating for them because they know that someone has already figured this thing out. And they're like, well, why don't you just give us the information?
Well, right, but that's not why Archer is upset. Archer is upset
because
Vulcans stopped his father from finishing his engine. And it's like, no, they didn't. The Vulcans actually are the reason it's his engine, because the Vulcans did just tell humans how to make engines.
Right.
Archer's dad would have been a nobody if the Vulcans had just given them the engine, because they wouldn't have needed warp engineers. They would have just been like, okay, we'll just use whatever the Vulcans make.
Yep.
Because it's way better than anything we could make on our own.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just going to say, I wanted to talk about the worst part of the episode, and those are the decon scenes. Because they are like, they are so
oiling themselves
forced,
up.
And they are actually... They are not at all sexy. They're supposed to be sexy. They're just kind of gross.
Yep.
And, like, no matter what way you look at it, and it's even stupider because it's like, wait a minute. So they have to, like, touch every part of their bodies with this cream, this oil cream that's supposed to desensitize them. So that's their excuse for why they need to, like, take off shirts. What about their crotches? They never put it there.
Obviously, as much as I would enjoy watching Tucker fondle his junk, I can't say I would want to have that scene.
It's like, are you suggesting... Like, that's why the scene is so stupid, because it's like, you know, wait, so they have to touch every part of themselves except their privates.
Well, don't you know that the junk never gets contaminated?
It never gets... It's impossible to get a disease there.
Yeah,
I heard about that.
It's cool. Space STD is not a thing.
It just... It
don't worry about it, bro.
It is just such an assaulting scene. It assaults you with how vulgar it is.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, you know, I mean, you know, I'll be straight up. I like pictures of naked things, regardless of what they are. But in this, it was just like, oh my goodness. I just felt, I felt like I was being assaulted by the television. And then, of course, shift over in a couple scenes later, and we have Archer wearing his tidy blues, which, like, are junk tight. They proudly display his junk for all to see. And we have, like, an entire scene of him prancing around his quarters in those, talking to his dog. And it's like, oh, stop it. Stop it. Aim the camera somewhere else. Oh, my goodness.
Scott Bakula junk. More of it.
Why Scott Bakula? Why? And those two scenes are just really disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, just to show Enterprise isn't above a little bit of bad storyboarding, there's this hilarious moment where T'Pol and Tucker are arguing about whether or not they're going to go back to the pod to rescue Archer.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the Zindi spaceship to rescue Archer.
Right.
And they haven't, like, actually resolved that argument. They're still arguing, and in the next scene, they're going back to rescue him. It's like, wait, what happened to the argument they were having? They were having an argument. Is the argument done? Did they resolve it? How did they resolve it? I don't understand. And it's just, my goodness. So, like, I actually have to say that this episode isn't as bad as Caretaker, but it's still really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because there's some parts where, like, the messages are really unclear. Like, they're talking about Klang, and of course, Klang being the Klingon that they've captured, that they're trying to get back to Kronos. That's the whole point of their mission.
It's a Klingon.
Yeah, Klingon, as one of the Klingon, as one of the human ambassadors says.
From Kronos.
From Kronos. And it's really funny because they keep saying clang, and it's like, wait, that's just a noise that, like, two pieces of metal make. Clang. But, like
that's how you get Klingon's names. You throw a bunch of quarters into the dryer.
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, the Vulcans want to, like, take him off life support, as it were, right? And
right.
Let him die, but it's unclear whether those are the orders from Kronos, and the humans are choosing to ignore them, or if that's just what the Vulcans want to do because it would be easier.
That's what the Vulcans want to do because of their understanding of
no, but they
Klingon.
Have a
well, at least they're spouting that excuse anyway to Archer.
But they
and
have
all
a
the
lot of dialogue
there.
That indicates that maybe Kronos ordered them to take him off of life support because it would be an honorable death. Like, there's a line of dialogue where they kind of indicate that, but they don't ever actually confirm it. They cannot confirm or deny whether or not they were told to do this.
Huh.
Yeah, it is a really weird scene. And then, of course, like, I mean, basically, this episode, you know, where Voyager is an episode, like, where Caretaker is a bunch of people, like, a bunch of poorly storyboarded scenes, this is an episode where people just fail. People are failing constantly in this episode. Tucker is failing to fly the pod, the crew is failing to find anything in the spaceport, Archer is failing to report into Starfleet Command. This is a mission of failure, because this episode is supposed to be funny, and that was all that the writers...
Oh, and 4 days from Earth to...
Kronos.
Yeah.
That too. At warp 5, mine. And, like, it's just really bizarre because I think because the Enterprise writers think that failure is funny, and they wanted it to have, like, some comic relief, but, like, after watching them bumble around for, like, an hour and a half, because it's a two-part episode, it's just like, wait a minute, this is what we have to expect from the rest of the show? They're just gonna fail their way through space?
Well, it is their first deep exploration ship.
Right, but it's, like, it's not like,
So that is kind of the mission statement for the show, anyway.
No, because it's not like they are
unofficially,
like,
that's how I would put it, anyway.
Oh, but it's not like they're out there, failing because of adversity, they're just incompetent. Like,
that's true.
That's, like, their big thing, is that they just don't really know what they're doing, because that's, like, because, again, that's what they think is funny, as you can see with Neelix. Like, Neelix's entire character was based on the idea that incompetence is funny.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, just, you know, I don't think true most of the time, especially in a serious drama. That's sort of what Enterprise sets you up to expect, is more failure, is they're going to fail their way through space.
Uh-huh.
Which, I guess, to be fair, it was honest in that, because that is what happens, especially in seasons 1 and 2.
So you're saying expectations were set up,
yeah.
And then they met those expectations.
Yes, they did.
So it was a success, then.
I guess in a way it did succeed. All right, so I promised myself that it... Oh, wait, one more, like, random piece of trivia. The original series episodes are 50 minutes long. Nowadays, TV shows are, like, 42 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost 8 minutes of television since the 80s, or since the 60s. Like,
huh,
commercials have gotten 8 minutes longer. Oh, my God, I'm sad. All right. So I guess now, I guess the only thing that's left, now that we've, you know, raged about these for more than an hour, the only thing that's left is to rate them in order. All right, so...
From worst to best?
Yeah, from worst to best. All right, so worst is... I'm going to have to go with Caretape. Wait, no. God, it's a really close tie between Farpoint and Caretape.
What's the criteria? Are we talking about, as in, like, the case of Enterprise, where they set expectations and they clearly met them for the rest of the series, or... the construction of the episode, or whether or not we liked it due to, like, the characters or the story. What's the criteria that we're rating them in?
Well, I'm going to go
we're
ahead.
Rating them with.
I'm gonna say we can't give Enterprise a break for the rest of the show also being bad, because that's not what they were trying to do. They're trying to make you think the show is going to be good, and they, like, have all these special effects going in this big space battle, which is the same thing they did in Caretaker. They have a big space battle to try to keep you interested. But I think overall, I think actually as worst first episode, it's a hard choice, but I'm gonna have to give it to Farpoint, because Farpoint is so slow. And say what you want about the other episodes, they at least have moderate to decent pacing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gonna have to give it to Farpoint, just because Farpoint is so boring, because nothing happens in Farpoint. It's just like these long plotting, like, expositionatory scenes. And, like, when something finally does happen, no one takes it seriously, and, like, you know, no one is really all that concerned.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one I would put it worst would have to be Caretaker.
You think it's Caretaker?
Caretaker, for me, anyway, because mm-hmm. of all the storyboarding issues that you've pointed out, for
yeah.
instance. You know, if a thing isn't, you know, contiguous in some manner, then it's like, you know, why did you bother throwing this in front of me in the first place?
That's fair. I would definitely put Caretaker as the second worst, with Enterprise, Broken Bow being the third.
Broken Bow would have to be my next at that point. So that's fourth on the list for me is
yeah.
Broken Bow. Because I really disliked what was being set up in terms of Trek lore.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were being fed totally different stuff from what we had understood Trek lore to be prior
yeah.
to that. I'm a pretty big Trek buff.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
I like the history of it. I love getting into, like, the tech manuals, reading about it, all that stuff. And it was setting up a different history from what I knew, understood, and felt very comfortable with at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't like it for that reason.
Well, that's fair enough.
The next one on the list for me would have to be Encounter at Farpoint.
Okay.
So campy.
Yeah, so your list in terms of worst goes Caretaker, Broken Bow, Farpoint. My list goes Farpoint, Caretaker, Broken Bow.
Right, so what's your what's your second place one there for best?
All right, well, second place, I'm going to have to go with Mantrap. I think Mantrap are in second place.
Same for me.
I'm not going to rank The Cage or Where No Man Has Gone Before, because those ones, no one ever actually saw them.
Well, we're going with the first one aired, right?
Yeah.
First episode aired. So that's setting up the rest of the series.
And, of course, because we both really love Deep Space Nine...
Emissary
wins the prize for best pilot.
No Man.
For best first episode.
Unfortunately, Garrick doesn't get any cake because he wasn't there.
It's okay. It's in the next one.
He is in the next one.
It'll be fine.
But we're not talking about the second episode.
No,
we're talking about the first.
I'll tell you what we're talking about next week. We're talking about the last episode of each series. And Garrick is in the last episode of Deep Space Nine.
He is. We'll see if he gets cake, though.
Probably. A little bit of cake.
A little bit of cake.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. This is All Things Trek signing off.